and take a look at what they believe, and then take a look at what the scriptures have to say. And so the first couple slides here is just going to be a review for us, pointing out, and after class last week, I had a lot of comments about this, going, how can anybody believe this? Because it's pretty, well, you'll see, it's pretty out there. One of the things that they believe and teach is that the second coming of Christ occurred more than 1900 years ago. And the key date is 70 AD, when Jerusalem was destroyed. And that's what we're going to take a look at today, the second coming of Christ, and see what exactly the scriptures have to say about that. They also teach that at that time, on 70 AD, Jesus established his eternal kingdom with glory and power. They believe the church was established in AD 33, but it wasn't established with glory and power. It didn't happen until 70 AD. And last week we took a look at that and saw that in AD 33, it was established with glory and power. That's what the scriptures teach. They also teach that at 70 AD, the resurrection of the dead occurred. That's when the resurrection took place. They also teach that on 70 AD, the final judgment took place then, and the end of the world happened at that same time. Breaking it down even just a little further, kind of explaining a little bit more, they teach that the kingdom of God came with glory and power, as I've already stated, in 70 AD, not on Pentecost. And that the law of Moses, I didn't point this out last week, continued to be in effect until 70 AD. It was 70 AD, very important date. Another aspect dealing with this, which we're dealing with today, the second coming of Christ has passed, having happened in 70 AD, and there will not be a second coming of Christ again. It's done. Which leads to the next point. The day of judgment came in 70 AD, and there will be no future judgment day taking place. And that the earth then will remain forever. The end of the world, and their definitions, we're going to deal with this last, the end of the world. Their definition of the world is different from the scriptural definition of the word world. And body in the resurrection, because they say the resurrection took place in 70 AD, and the believer will not have a bodily resurrection. Their definition of body is different from what the scriptures have to teach. You know, and as I said, a lot of times people take a look at this doctrine and they take a look at this teaching and they say, well, that's just craziness. How can anybody follow it? But we need to understand that this is causing problems all over the country. Several places are dealing with it. Within 60 miles of this building, they're dealing with this problem. One of the things that does take place is that these brethren who hold this doctrine do not believe that this doctrine is a basis for fellowship. So they can fellowship with those who do not hold this doctrine. And they're coming into congregations and teaching this doctrine behind closed doors. And it's causing problems. Now, who would be at risk of falling prey to this doctrine? Who do you think would be at risk?
Somebody having knowledge of the Bible?
Yes. Somebody doesn't have knowledge of the Bible. It kind of goes back to Hosea, does it not? What did God say in Hosea about His people? They're destroyed for what reason? A lack of knowledge. And this has always been the case, which implies to us we need to make sure we have the knowledge necessary that we need to have within our lives. And last week, as I said, we took a look at the kingdom and saw that it did come in glory in 33 AD. And this week we're going to take a look at the second coming of Christ. And before we get into specifically the second coming of Christ, there's some preliminary information we need to address. And I'm going to move quickly till we get to Matthew 24. I don't want to take any more than three more weeks. I'm teaching Hebrews, then I got the providence of God after this class. So I got a lot I got to prepare for. So I don't want to extend this any further than I have to. I don't want to detract anyone from making comments, so please make comments if you want to make comments. But there are going to be times I'm going to move quickly, and then there are going to be times that I kind of slow down. We first need to realize a basic fact about the comings of Christ. Notice how I have that worded. How is that worded? Plural. Okay? There is more than one type of coming of Jesus Christ recorded for us in the Scriptures. And what happens is that the 70 ADist kind of merges and blurs those two different comings. And they want to teach us really basically one type of coming of Jesus. There are two types of comings in the New Testament of Christ. What are the two types of comings of Jesus in the New Testament? What are the two types of comings? Coming how? How will he come? What's that? Okay. A literal coming of Jesus Christ. He will literally come back, but there's another type of coming. What's the other type? A figurative or symbolic. A figurative or symbolic coming, and as Jacob pointed out, he didn't hear him, in judgment. Okay, so there's two actually types of comings of Jesus Christ as recorded in the New Testament. And Max King and his followers confuse these two different types of comings. And we need to be aware of that. I'm going to take a look at both of them here in just a second. There are actually two times in the Bible that Jesus is going to come literally unto this earth. When are they? When was the first literal coming of Jesus Christ, where he literally came to the earth? When he was born and walked on the earth. He was literally on this earth. And the Old Testament prophesied that that would be the case. But there is a second literal coming talked about in the Bible with Jesus Christ. And when is that to take place? Okay, nobody knows. When is that though? Okay, on his second coming. He will literally come on the earth. Now, how many scriptures are there in the New Testament that tell us he is literally going to come back upon this earth? Anybody have an idea as to how many there are? I came up with only two. We're going to take a look at both of them. Where it says he will literally come back. Now, there's a reference to his, many references to his second coming, but in those it does not say he is literally going to come back. Turn over to Acts chapter 1, and let's take a look at verse 11. What's happening in Acts chapter 1 here? Oh, it's Jesus' ascension. He has been on the earth after his resurrection, talking to his apostles, and as he ascends up to heaven, notice what the angel says in verse 11. Which also said, ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus which is taken up from you into heaven shall so come in like manner as you have seen him go into heaven. So the angel is saying is that he is going to come back to earth literally the exact same way he left the earth. Notice Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 28. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 28. So Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many, and unto them that look for him shall he appear the second time without sin unto salvation. He is going to be here a second time upon this earth. Literally. Second coming. Now, Max King contends that both of these passages, as well as the 70 ADists, denote a figurative coming by Christ when Jerusalem was destroyed. The 70 AD theorists will argue both passages, as I said, occurred in 70, or they'll argue that occurred in 70 AD. And we'll see here in just a little bit that that is not true at all when we get to Matthew chapter 24. So that's the first type, literally coming back. But as Jacob already pointed out, there's a figurative coming of Jesus Christ. Not everywhere when the Bible talks about Jesus coming is the Bible saying that he is going to come literally. There are times that it says Jesus is going to come, but he's talking figuratively. And we need to understand the difference between the two and be able to identify, especially with these folks, when Jesus is going to, when the passage is dealing with Jesus coming in a figurative way. Now, there are a ton of passages. I'm just going to put up two because of time. Okay, but I think these two demonstrate that They are not dealing with a literal coming of Jesus Christ, but we're dealing with a figurative coming. Turn over to the book of John, chapter 14. Verse 23. And I'll slow down a bit now. If a man love me, he will keep my word, and the Father will love him, and we will come and make our abode with him. Is this literal? Does Jesus and God literally come and live with us in our houses when we render obedience unto him? No. Do you have him living in your house? Is he sleeping in a bed somewhere? Literal coming means he will literally in body form be there. When Jesus comes back a second time, he is literally coming back. So what is Jesus saying here then in John 14 and verse 23? What's he saying? What's that? What's that? Okay. In spirit? How does he do that today? We talked about that in Hebrews, that we are the tabernacle and God dwells within us. How does that take place? Is it a literal dwelling by God in Jesus? Jacob? Okay. And how does that happen, though? What does that look like for him to abide in us? Because that's what he's saying. James? Let me give you some help. Turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and read verse 18 for us out loud. 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 18. Yeah, out loud, please. That's all right. All right, so what does Paul tell us in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 18 about us? Yeah, we're being changed into his image from glory to glory, from the time we are obedient until the day that we die. From glory to glory, we're being changed into his image. John 14 and verse 23, I believe, is a reference to his spiritual presence in our lives. He is not literally living in our house. This is a symbolic, this is a figurative coming of Christ. He is spiritually present within our lives as we assimilate His Word, as was read by in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 18, as James read for us. We're changed into Christ Himself. And that is seen through our actions, through our words. See, this is not a literal coming. Jesus says, I'm going to come unto you. But this is not a literal. Remember the topic here that's under discussion. This is not a literal coming of Jesus. He does not literally come to us, sit down with us, eat with us, and live in our homes with us when we become obedient to Him. Not the case. This is a symbolic, a spiritual coming of Christ into our lives. Does everybody see that? One more passage. Turn over to Revelation chapter 3 and verse 20. And notice what he says to the church here. Jesus says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man will hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him and will take supper with him, and he with me." I chose this one for a specific reason, because it corresponds to what we were just talking about. Jesus says he is going to literally come unto us if we allow him to come into our lives and do what? What does he say? Eat supper with us. Literal? Did Jesus eat supper with you last night? Did you set an extra plate? And I don't want to be, flippant about this. But if you say every time Jesus comes in the New Testament is a literal coming, that's what this is saying. Did that take place? No. So in what sense then is the word come used here? Bill? No, I don't think it's the Lord's Supper. I think it's more than that. It's what we were just talking about in John as well. This is in a fellowship sense. This is in a fellowship sense. Here was a congregation that was going astray, had gone astray. And Jesus, and they had shut the Lord out of their lives, and he was trying to get back into their lives. Notice the way I have that worded, because that's the way Jesus has it worded. When we stop obeying Jesus, we close the door to him in our lives. And Jesus is knocking at the door. He's trying to get back with them in order to have fellowship with them. Again, this is not a literal coming, as we've already talked about. He is not literally going to have supper with us. This is a spiritual presence of the Lord with his people. Is he with us in a spiritual sense? Yes. Is he with us in a literal sense? According to the book of Acts, where is Jesus literally right now? In heaven at the right hand of God. He is not with us literally. We know where he is at. So this is not a literal presence. This is not a literal coming by Jesus here. This is symbolic. This is figurative. And we need to understand not all passages that talk about Jesus' coming are talking about a literal coming of Jesus Christ. I could go on. There are tons of passages like this. I think the point is made with just these two. So let's turn over to Matthew chapter 24 and let's get into the heart of the lesson. As I've already pointed out, the 70 ADists will confuse the comings of Christ. And this is the case in Matthew chapter 24 and 25. They make the coming of Christ, or actually the comings of Christ, as recorded in Matthew chapter 24, the same as the coming of Christ later in chapter 24 and into chapter 25 as well. They fail to distinguish between a figurative coming of Christ as compared to a literal coming of Jesus Christ. And the difficulty in Matthew chapter 24 is that there is a figurative coming of Christ and a literal coming of Christ talked about. And so we've got to be able to discern between the two. Both are talked about in Matthew 24. And if you're not careful and don't know the Scriptures, it's going to be hard to discern the difference between the two, because Matthew chapter 24 is a difficult passage. To say the least. And I'm just going to tell you right now, I have no intention of going through it and dealing with all those difficult passages, because we would be here to the end of next week as well. We're going to touch on a few of those, but I want to get the main idea and see that we're talking about two different types of comings in Matthew chapter 24. And as I indicate, that is a serious problem. Let's go over to Matthew 24 and let's take a look at verses 1 and 2 then. See what's happening, the context of this chapter. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, "See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." All right? The disciples and Christ are looking at the many beautiful buildings, the beautiful stones that had gone to compose these different buildings within the temple and the buildings surrounding the temple. And Jesus tells them, one day these are going to be destroyed. One day they will not be here. So the disciples, and along with the 70 ADists, I believe, get a little confused. Notice verse 3. Okay, I'm just going to give you my opinion of verse 3 here. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us when these things will be. In reference to what? What is that first question asking? In reference to, Todd's looking his head like this. Verses 1 and 2, when the temple is going to be destroyed. Tell us when these things are going to be. Now notice what they also ask. And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now, there are actually two questions asked in verse 3. And Jesus answers two questions in chapter 24, and I think I can show you that pretty easily. The disciples are asking two different questions. When is the temple going to be destroyed? And the second question is, when's the second coming going to take place and the end of the world going to occur? In my mind, after studying all the disciples and what their understanding of the kingdom was before Acts chapter 2, you know, when they asked, when are you going to restore the kingdom of Israel? They had a misunderstanding. Acts chapter 2, it becomes all cleared up for them. My mind, they think they're asking one question. I really believe that. And what Jesus does is he says, you're asking two different questions. And so he answers two different ways. Okay? So the disciples, I think here, and it's my opinion, the disciples, I believe, are a little confused as well. All right? But I want to point out to you, and we're going to see it here right now, that there are two different questions that the disciples asked. Because there are two different events they are making reference to. And Jesus clearly points that out to them. So let's take a look here. Yeah, go ahead. No, I don't. That's what I just said. I think the disciples misunderstood that. So Jesus here is correcting. He's showing them that it's two different questions. I think the disciples were asking one question, but Jesus answers it answers two questions. Okay, that's just my opinion. You can take it for what it is. All right, let me catch up to myself. So Jesus begins answering the first question. When is Jerusalem going to be destroyed? And understand he goes with that in answering that question down to verse 35. Okay, so the first question is answered in the verses 4 through verse 35. All right, so let's take a look at what he has to say. Verse 4, and Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, say, am I in Christ, and shall deceive many. Notice verse 6 through 8, and ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass when the end is not yet, the end of Jerusalem. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilence and earthquakes in diverse places. And these are the beginning of the sorrows. What is Jesus doing here? And he's going to continue doing this, and we're going to see this, through verse 35. What's he doing here to answer their question? When is Jerusalem going to be destroyed? What's he doing? He's preparing them, but he's also showing them what? That there's going to be what leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem? There's going to be signs. And he says, here are the signs of the destruction of Jerusalem. You will know when Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. Because there are going to be many false Christs coming. There's going to be wars and rumors of wars taking place. Notice verses 9 and 10. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. What's another sign of the destruction of Jerusalem taking place? Here in verses 9 and 10, what's another sign? Persecutions. There's going to be heavy persecutions that are going to take place before Jerusalem or is destroyed. Notice verses 11 through 13. And many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that is endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. What's the next sign that Jesus says is going to take place before the destruction of Jerusalem? Increase in lawlessness, false prophets, terrible things are going to be taking place. Notice verse 13, the next sign. Excuse me, verse 14. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Nick, turn over to Colossians chapter 1 and get ready to read verse 23 for me. What's he say is going to take place before the destruction of Jerusalem, according to verse 14? The gospel is going to be preached to who? To where? How far? The entire world is going to hear the gospel. Nick, what does Colossians 1:23 say?
If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister.
By the time he wrote Colossians, what had occurred? According to verse 23. The gospel had been preached to who? Everyone. Does that mean in the Americas and South America? I take it for what it says. We don't know much about the other apostles other than the ones recorded. And there's not every apostle recorded in the New Testament, is there? But I do know when there was an Ethiopian eunuch that wanted to hear the word of God, what did God do? He sent him a preacher. So I don't know what happened to all those other apostles. But I know by verse 23 of chapter 1 of the book of Colossians, every creature on the face of the earth had heard the gospel. I believe that, because that's what it says. But notice what Jesus says back to Matthew 24. Notice what Jesus says. The gospel first has to be preached to every creature under heaven before this event will take place. And we know that it took place in the first century. Verse 15, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whoso readeth, let him understand. You know, he says, the prophet Daniel prophesied about the destruction of Jerusalem. Understand and realize when it's going to take place. Now notice verses 16 through 20, an important passage, I believe. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child and to them that give suck in those days. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. What is Jesus telling his people to do here? When you see these signs coming, what are you to do? Get out of Jerusalem. Get out of Dodge. That's right. Get out. That's exactly right. And that's what we see Jesus telling them to do. And remember that here in just a second. Notice verses 21 through 32. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. But I have told you before, wherefore, if they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, he is in the secret chambers, believe it not. For as a lightning cometh out of the east, and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there shall the eagles be gathered together. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light. And the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. This is His coming. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. And they shall gather together his elect from the four winds and from one end of the heaven to the other. Notice here, this is a passage that confuses the 70 ADs. Jesus is not talking about His second coming. And we'll see that in a second. He will deal with that beginning in verse 36. What is He still talking about? What is the context of this section of Matthew 24? It's the destruction of Jerusalem. He is going to come. But it's a figurative coming, as we've already seen. It's a coming in judgment upon Jerusalem. And there are going to be horrible consequences. He's already said that is going to be destroyed. Verses 33 and 34, sort of, kind of important I have here. And indeed they are. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Notice verse 33. What does he say about verse 33? You shall what? About the judgment on Jerusalem. You shall what? You shall know it. It will be evident. There are signs, and I'm emphasizing that for a reason. There are signs that will take place. Jesus is emphasizing that in giving all of these signs concerning the destruction of Jerusalem. And he even goes so far as to say, verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Josephus and other historians tell us that in the weeks leading up to the Romans surrounding the city, every single Christian fled Jerusalem. When Jerusalem was destroyed, not a single Christian was killed, according to Josephus and other historians from the first century. Why? They saw the signs and did what? They left. Notice, this is just telling you how terrible the destruction was. When the Roman legions destroyed Judea and Jerusalem in AD 70, Josephus says that more than 1.1 million Jews died and nearly 100,000 were taken captive. In Rome's ancient form, the Arch of Titus, which still stands, depicts Jewish captives in chains and Roman soldiers carrying the seven-branched temple candlestick on their shoulders. Yet while the Jews suffered starvation, slaughter, and capture, it was a horrible time. You read the history books. People were eating each other. They were eating the dead. It was a terrible, terrible destruction of Jerusalem. The cannibalism. Notice what he has to say about Christians. As Vespasian was approaching with his army, all who believed in Christ left Jerusalem and fled to Pella and other places beyond the river Jordan. And so they all marvelously escaped the general shipwreck of their country. Not one of them perished. Eusebius, early Christian scholar, says, the whole body, however, of the church at Jerusalem, having been commanded by a divine revelation given to men of approved piety there before the war, removed from the city and dwelt at a certain town beyond the Jordan called Pella. One other historian, Epiphanes, also attests to the Christians' escape according to the Bible scholar Adam Clark. The latter wrote, it is very remarkable that not a single Christian perished in the destruction of Jerusalem. Though there were many there when Cestius Gallus invested the city, a lead group came to the city before Vespasian did, and had been, persevered in the siege, he would have soon have rendered himself master of it. But when they unexpectedly and unaccountably raised the siege, the Christians took that opportunity to escape. How did they know Jerusalem was going to be destroyed? The signs. The signs. There were many signs leading up to. And Jesus points them out to the point that the Christians were able to understand Jerusalem was going to be destroyed. They knew when that time was going to occur. Now, notice verse 36. Now Jesus is going to answer the second question they asked in verse 3. When is the time of your coming and the end of the world? Notice what he says here. But of that day and hour knoweth no man. No, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. He can't be talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Why? Here are the signs. He says, you will know when the destruction of Jerusalem is going to take place because here are the signs. But now he gets to verse 36 and he says, but of that hour, the second coming, the second part of that question that the disciples asked in verse 3, he says, that hour, no one knows when that's going to take place. There are going to be no warnings, as we're going to see here. There's going to be no four signs that are going to take place before Jesus comes again. That's what Jesus is saying here. Jesus separates the two events that the disciples asked about in verse 3. He says there's one event, the destruction of Jerusalem. There's another event, my second coming and the end of the world. They're two different events. He has just given all these signs that's going to accompany the destruction of Jerusalem. He has listed over and over again, and then he says, you need to leave because Jerusalem is about to be destroyed when this takes place. But in verse 36, there are no signs. Not even Christ knows when that's going to occur. Not even the angels. There's only one being that knows, according to verse 36. And who is that? God. God. No one else knows when Christ is coming back. Notice verses 42 and 50. He repeats this. Watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. I mean, there's no way of getting around it. And then also notice verse 50. When he says, the Lord of thy servants shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of. These are two different events. The first was a figurative coming on judgment upon Jerusalem. Now Jesus is saying on that literal coming, that second coming, there's going to be no signs. You just need to be prepared. You just need to be prepared. And that's what he's saying in verses 38 and 39. My time's getting short. I want to finish this today. So I'm not going to take the time to read that, but you can read verse. Let's read verse 37. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Then the days of Noah, we know there was eating and drinking and giving them away in marriage. They had no clue that the flood was about to take place. That's what Jesus is saying. There were no signs. There were no signs. It just happened. Verses 38 and 39. The point is that no one was warned on what exact day the flood would come. All right. As I've already said and I've indicated, and I'm beating a dead horse to death, but I want to, what Jesus is saying in this section is that we just need to be prepared for it. Verses 40 and 41, two verses that a lot of people have trouble with. Take it in the context of the second coming and being prepared. Then shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill and the one shall be taken and the other left. This is symbolism. What he's saying is one was prepared, one was not. That's the point. And that's what he goes on to say through the rest of this chapter and into chapter 25, is it not? With the virgins and with the other parables that he speaks. He's saying, be ready, be prepared for the coming of the Master. Be ready, be prepared. As I've already pointed out, the AD 70s confuse these two comings of Christ. They want to make both of the comings talked about in chapter 24 the same coming of Christ on Jerusalem. I think the text indicates that's not the case. Jesus' own words. He says there's plenty of signs for the destruction of Jerusalem, but for my coming, there are no signs. You just need to be prepared. You need to be ready for that, is what he's saying to them. As I said, I personally think that the disciples confused this just as much as the 70 AD's. I really do. I think they had they didn't realize that there were two different destructions. Because after all, for them, the temple was everything up to this point in time. Until Acts chapter 2, the temple was everything. It was their lives. It was their spiritual well-being. And if that ever ended, then the whole world was going to end. That was in their minds. And Jesus is saying that's not the case. They understood that after Acts chapter 2. But at this time, I don't think they did. And there's a lot of people today still having trouble with discerning between the literal and figurative comings of Jesus Christ. The destruction of Jerusalem has indeed occurred. The second coming of Christ has not occurred, and we will not see any signs before He comes again. We just need to be prepared for it. We also need to be able to distinguish as to when the New Testament is talking about symbolic comings and literal comings of Jesus in judgment. And I rushed through that, but I wanted to get done with that. If you have questions, I'll be more than happy to answer any of the questions you have. But the point thing I want you to realize is that those that hold the 70 AD theory will teach that the second coming of Jesus Christ occurred on 70 AD, and their point to Matthew chapter 24 is a proof text of that. Because that, if you don't understand the two different comings, if you don't look at the context, you get confused on that. Jacob? And applying it to the second coming of Christ.
Yeah, applying it to today.
That's a good point.
Let's look at, you know, all these nations get into big war, or some dictator comes to power, or something like that. And even like verse 34, Moses translates the word generation.
Yes.
And some people say that can be race, and he's talking more about the Jewish race.
Yeah. And that's an excellent point. So there's still a lot of confusion in Matthew 24 today. Next week we will deal with the resurrection. They teach the resurrection's already taken place. So we'll be dealing with 1 Corinthians 15 because they have a different view of it than actually what the Scriptures teach. So you can prepare by reading 1 Corinthians chapter 15 for next week. Thank you for your attention today.